Welcome to The Upper Hand, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all aspects of hand surgery, from technical to personal.
Thank you for subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
All right, we're back. I would like to know more about how you treat patients surgically. So let's go back to our 40-some-odd-year-old lady with nighttime awakenings, intermittent daytime symptoms, and no static changes on exam. She wants surgery. She wants to sleep at night. So what do you tell her? What options do you give her surgically, anesthesia-wise? And what are the numbers you quote to her as far as expectations of success?
So, we've established that this is a carpal tunnel patient, and we've excluded or at least pushed to the back burner any other associated type of conditions. And I tell her that I think she would benefit from a carpal tunnel release, and I think that we could help her sleep better. Our goal would be to stop compression on the nerve and hopefully reverse some of those issues that have been going on with causing numbness and tingling. You know, she doesn't have any weakness at this point, but it is helpful to tell her, we're going to stop this from getting worse and hopefully ever coming back. My default is to counsel them about having it under local, so I've followed with the wide awake local anesthesia no tourniquet protocol. Just in my practice, that's still done in the operating room. The block is done in holding. Haven't been able to get that procedure out of the operating room yet, but certainly we're going to keep trying on that. In terms of expectations, like I said, a counselor saying I think she's going to sleep better at night. I try not to quote numbers just in general with patients, although if they press me, I'll tell them. And I think that recurrence rates are certainly something to discuss, or at least acknowledging the possibility that it may come back even after what many would consider a successful release. If there's anything questionable in history that leads us to think of, alternative diagnoses or concomitant diagnoses, I tell them we may need to go back and address your cubital tunnel or address your Lacertus, or you may need to see somebody for your neck or do some therapy along those lines.
Perfect. Briefly, I generally see it the same way. I agree with surgery for this patient, given that that's what she wants. I will do local only, but I tend to, because of where I work and a lot of variable factors, I now offer every patient local only, and I would say 25% are interested. That may be on me, and maybe it should be a higher number, and I assume it will become a higher number. I do all of those in the operating room just like you, even though we operate at different satellites. I do like numbers, and so here are the numbers I quote. I tell a patient like this that she has at least an 85% chance of a cure, and I do use that word. I tell her about 10% of the time she'll be better, but maybe not perfect. And I tell her 5% of the time she may be neither better nor worse. And if that were the case, probably related to either a wrong diagnosis or a misdiagnosis, I tell them her risk of complications is, not zero, is very low. I reinforce it's a surgery I really like.
Yeah, and I think that, they get the sense of, I think, how confident you are, based on the way you present it. And when you tell somebody, either with numbers or just by looking them in the eyes, saying, I think I can help you, it's a powerful thing for a patient.
Absolutely. So talk me through, just for those of us who don't do a lot, exactly what you inject. You said you do it in the preoperative holding area, maybe, I assume, 10 or 15 minutes ahead of time. But just talk through that process for me.
So it's been interesting to try to work it into the workflow, your standard OR day. I try to do it at least 20 to 30 minutes before the procedure, or before I think I'll be, doing the procedure, because the maximum efficacy of that local anesthetic and the epinephrine part of it doesn't really kick in until about that 25-30 minute mark. So I'll see them in holding. We'll mark them, do the timeout. I draw out my normal incisions that I would, or my normal markings that I would for my incision. And I tell them, I use lidocaine, 1 to 100,000, 1% lidocaine with 1 to 100,000 epinephrine, prepackaged. I don't buffer it with any bicarb. I know that that's the original way that Dr. Lalonde has described it, but there's a good paper from our group that demonstrates that may not actually have a lot of effect in terms of controlling the pain. I know others feel strongly in the other direction. And then for a carpal tunnel, I don't formally block the carpal tunnel like Dr. Lalonde does. I found that that was an uncomfortable step for patients in the holding area. So I will start my local following the principles of proximal to distal, so just proximal to the wrist crease, just underneath the skin. It's certainly a less sensitive, although not perfect area, than going into the palm to start. So I'll raise a small wheel there, and you will see the blanching. And then I just proceed proximal to distal from there, trying to poke the skin the minimum amount of times by angling the needle and that kind of thing. I usually won't use more than 15 to 20 cc's of that mixture for carpal tunnels, oftentimes using slightly less than that. And I just try to make sure I cover as much of the area as I need. Do you do anything differently?
No, about the same. I tend to do it in the operating room. I'm lucky in that I have two rooms, and so I might run over, inject the patient, but that means 5 or 10 minutes setup time. Mm-hmm. But it seems to work well for me. I tend to inject about 10 cc's total. But it's worked very well for me when the patient. And you know what? I agree with those who say it's kind of fun. I wouldn't want to do all my cases having a conversation with every patient, but for the right patient, it's highly enjoyable for both parties.
Yeah, I think some patients really enjoy getting behind the scenes in the OR. Some patients are terrified by it. I offer patients the opportunity to watch their surgery, and I'm totally okay with that. It's just a matter of whether they have the stomach for it. My anecdotal series is that patients who have watched videos on the internet beforehand are not going to watch their surgery. And patients who watch their surgery end up being really intrigued by it, I think.
Huh. That's awesome. So tell me technically, what does Dr. D's carpal tunnel release surgery look like? Are you doing a quote-unquote standard carpal tunnel, a mini incision carpal tunnel? Are you crossing the wrist crease? I know you don't do it endoscopically, and we can talk about that, but what is your technique?
So I think that my incision is slightly larger than a mini open. It's definitely bigger than what I saw you do when I was in training with you. I don't cross the wrist crease routinely, except if I'm in a revision or in the setting of a distal radius fracture is when I'll cross the wrist crease or any other wrist pathology. I like a curvilinear incision, and it's essentially over that interthenar eminence, but I do cheat it slightly ulnarly. There's a series of anatomic papers that demonstrate the course of the palmar cutaneous branch of the median nerve, and if you are just ulnar to that interthenar eminence, you're pretty safe. I don't use the flex finger as a guideline. I'll typically take something straight like a marking pen and go from the third web space. And then pointing directly towards the middle of the wrist and use that as a center. And I just like the curve because it lets me see things a little better, but I certainly could do it through a straight incision. One thing that's interesting to me is, after I mark the incision, I take a step back and look at it to make sure I'm not sitting too ulnar. Because sometimes, depending on how you have the palm positioned, you mark and you say, gosh, if I saw that back in the clinic, I'd say that's a little too ulnar or a little too radial or whatever. So I just take a second, I pause, and I look at how I mark the incision.
I think that's great. One of our partners likes a really ulnar incision, basically just off the hook of the hammy. I don't like that, number one, because I don't think it's necessary to go that far ulnar. Number two, when you put your retractors in, you end up really putting your retractors onto the ulnar bundle, and I don't like that.
Yeah.
Tom Kiefarber taught me how to do a carpal tunnel release, and I do exactly what he taught me in fellowship, unchanged 20 years later. 2-centimeter incision, beginning just distal to the wrist crease to try to avoid some of those crossing sensitive nerve branches. and I use 2 cents and a rag nail, and it's a sharp, completely sharp release, except for the most distal aspect of the transcarpal ligament and the most distal aspect of the antebrachial fascia. And that's all I do. I think we certainly agree on this. I hope everyone agrees on this, that's it. You release the transcarpal ligament, make sure there's nothing compressing proximally or distally, and you're done.
Yeah, no, I think that, there is enough literature out there demonstrating that an internal neurolysis doesn't add much to the outcomes. You could argue that those are older papers without the best methodology, but certainly now we've been doing it this way for a number of years and it's worked out all right. So,
absolutely. It's crazy when we think about what used to be done with carpal tunnel releases, with admissions to the hospital, mm-hmm. with casting mm-hmm. or plaster splinting afterwards and therapy. We really have come a long way to keeping this to be very simplistic.
So then what's your dressing and your post-op counseling in terms of instructions and when you have them back and that kind of thing?
Yeah, one of the things that's great about a podcast, as I'm learning, is that you can't hide. I'm going to say something, and I'm sure someone listening is going to be like, what is he saying, and why is he saying that? So,
well, you told me I can do this, Dr. Goldfarb.
Yeah, so we're putting ourselves out there, which is fine. Everything's discussable. So I close with 4-0 nylon. I've experimented with other things. I like it. 2 or 3 horizontal mattress sutures. If I don't do a local only, then I tend to inject 5 to 6 cc's of 0.5% plain marcaine for afterwards. I put a very small dressing, adapt it, a couple of 4x4s, and usually I use an ace bandage just because that comes in the pack rather than a Coban. I let my patients take off the dressing in 3 days and shower. I ask them not to soak or scrub their wound. They can type or write the same day. I ask them to avoid heavy gripping and grasping, not because I'm worried it's going to hurt something, but they may have increased discomfort.
I do it the same way, except I do 5 days because you told us that's the way the hand service was supposed to do it, and we weren't so severe from that. But now I'm going to go change all my paperwork because I would love to do 3 days. I've toyed with the idea of using an absorbable suture. I know Catherine Curtin published a paper recently looking at different sutures that were used, and that this was something I was a little more comfortable for patients. And honestly, anything that you can do to avoid that step of removing sutures in the office, because it's uncomfortable for patients and obviously has some workflow considerations, I'm thinking about it. But, you know, I've liked doing the closure in the way you described. Even with local onlys, I'll inject some bupivacaine at the end of the case. And honestly, that's sometimes the step that bothers them the most during the surgery, is because unless you warn them, that sudden feeling of fullness can be a little bothersome.
So in our patient, you know, we fully expect her to sleep better the night of the surgery. I think you would probably agree with that, even though she may have some surgical discomfort. What do you tell her about the next 2 to 4 weeks and then the next, you know, 4 to 8 weeks?
So I include this in the pre-op counseling. I tell her it's going to feel like she has a deep cut in her palm because that's what she has. And, you know, I talk from the very beginning about pillar pain and the possibility of that, and just some soreness when they go, you know, go to push off of a chair or to, you know, try to get out of bed. They're going to feel that soreness, and they're going to hopefully be feeling so good that they're going to try to do some things that they weren't doing before. So I tell them that feeling of either, you know, pain in those muscles at the base of the palm or just that sensitivity over the scar can last as long as, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, although most people are over that by 2 to 4 weeks from the surgery.
And what's the role of bilateral carpal tunnel release in your practice? So if this patient, for example, had exactly the same symptoms on each side, would you offer bilateral? Would you push for bilateral? What are your thoughts?
The first screening question I have for that is, you know, first of all, does this bother you enough to have both sides done, you know, either at the same time or within a few weeks of each other? And then the second screening question is, do you live alone? I think that's a big difference maker, because if they live alone, there's no way I'm offering bilateral carpal tunnel release. Although they probably could get along just fine, they're just not going to love it. But if they have somebody that can help them through those first 3 to 5 days that I offer to them, I like the study that that you guys did with Dan Osei, and I think that's a helpful study to counsel patients about what to expect. Everybody thinks it's going to be the hygiene stuff, but it's not necessarily that. It's the heavy doors, it's the pots and pans, so I tell them to either cook a bunch ahead of time or get ready to order some Domino's or whatever else they want to order. It has a role for me. I enjoy doing it for patients if they really want to do it, especially, you know, if they're looking to get back to things ASAP and just want to move on from having surgery. How about you?
Yeah, I it's all about how we say things. No matter how neutral we may believe we offer different treatment options, it's all about what we say and how we say it. I would estimate that in patients with bilateral carpal tunnel symptoms worthy of surgical intervention, 75% of my patients choose bilateral. And I'm happy to do it. It's another example of decreasing patient, shortening patient recovery time, decreasing cost to society, and decreasing reimbursement to Chuck. but that's fine, because it feels like the right thing to do when it's appropriate and when the patient wants it.
I would agree with you. I mean, so how do you, a lot of the patients who I think want to have bilateral carpal tunnel simultaneously are looking to get back to stuff. So when do you let, say if your patient was somebody behind a desk, when do you let them get back or counsel them on what to expect versus somebody who has more of a laborer type job?
My typical answer for laborers and my work comp patients is 4 weeks before they're back doing full duty. But they're a bricklayer. I send them back to work at 4 weeks to lay bricks, although there are always exceptions to that. But that's my general plan. I will let patients go back to typing literally the next day. But when you do bilaterals, it just slows everything down. As you know, I think it shortens the recovery, but it just slows things down. So I classically a non-work comp patient that I do a unilateral carpal tunnel. I happen to operate on Wednesdays, and I tell them to go back to work on Monday.
And what are the things that patients say that they have a hard time getting back to doing?
Thankfully, hardy Midwest population, I don't hear a lot of complaints from my typical patients. It is the things like heavy doors, whether it's unilateral, bilateral, getting back to yoga. But it's the things you might expect, the heavier demand type of activities. I don't get a lot of complaints about desk work. Do you?
So I don't. I don't. You know, and I think that the success of this surgery is one that makes us, I think at least me, I don't think we want to mess with it. But, you know, there are certainly a lot of people who advocate for doing more minimally invasive things with the goal of getting rid of some of that pillar pain, some of the discomfort, and hastening that recovery. Do you have any thoughts about endoscopic carpal tunnel release?
I went through a phase where I did endoscopic because, I thought it made some sense and the literature supported it. B, it seemed attractive for a workers' compensation practice as I was building that. And Dr. Gelberman is the one, and he did some research in this area, as you know, who actually said, why are you going to take an operation which is fun and safe and non-stressful for the surgeon and turn it into something which is none of those? And I think an endoscopic carpal tunnel, when everything goes great, is fun and is highly enjoyable and is safe. But unless you're doing it all the time, I just think it adds a level of stress which is not necessary. And I was fortunate. I never had a complication. I believe those who say that if you do routine endoscopic releases, your complication rate is no higher than opens. But for me, it was intermittent, and I didn't feel safe, and I have not looked back.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, it's all good till it's not. And I reviewed an article once. I don't know if it ever got published, but it was perceptions from hand therapists on open versus endoscopic carpal tunnel release. And they noted the same things that, you know, the advocates for an endoscopic would note, that, you know, the quicker return to function, etc. But when they were pressed about whether they would actually have it themselves, the majority of them said no. And the reason why is that if you have a complication, that's catastrophic. You know, an injury to the median nerve, that is a life-changing injury, patient and surgeon. So I you know, like you're saying, it's a great operation. I wouldn't mess with it at this point, but that's my own bias. Maybe we'll get some heat about it from listeners.
I hope we do. You know, we're overly affected by certain patients. And, you know, for most patients, I don't remember them for too long because they do well. I specifically remember one endoscopic release in a delightful little old lady who was tiny, and I bruised her median nerve. And I have never stressed like I stressed. And she recovered fully by 3 to 4 weeks, but it was a stressful 3 to 4 weeks. I assume people listening to, you know, and certainly you and I have talked about things like this, we inordinately stress over adverse events. And if I can minimize what I believe is a risk factor for an adverse event, I'm going to do it every time.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, honestly, I've trained with you. I know what you're, and I guess Dr. Kiefhaber's carpal tunnel incision looks like. It's pretty darn small, and I can't see how taking that and changing it is going to make you have a real effect.
Let's talk technical very quickly. So if you're anything like me, sharp incision through the skin, palmar fascia, isolate the transverse carpal ligament, ideally without cutting muscle, and you do your initial release. So when you go distally and you're talking to a resident, what do you tell them about the distal release? Do you use the classic bright yellow fat, you're done, or is it more complex than that?
So, you know, I think that, you know, you brought up a couple of points that I think are worthy of discussion. So how you handle the muscle, I think, and I'm not sure what's out there in the literature about this, that influences what type of discomfort they're going to have after surgery. If you proceed directly through those muscle fibers transversely in order to get down to the transverse carpal ligament, I think that causes more pain. And some patients are fortunate enough where their thenars don't overlap on their transverse carpal ligament. That's easier for everybody. But I do like to take the scalpel blade and brush those fibers off of their more ulnar insertion and see if we can gently do that in hopefully a less traumatic way. I know that we have differing feelings about the importance of memorizing anatomic factoids, especially with some of our other partners. But, you know, I think it does matter to know that the transverse carpal ligament is thickest in its midportion. Like you're saying, this is a sharp release. This is a touch procedure. So knowing that it is thickest in its mid portion, you know, says this is where you should get started. And, you know, I work just ulnar to the hook of the hamate in terms of where to release it, because we know all the stuff that we want to avoid is on the radial side of the carpal tunnel. You know, if you're worried about, say, the subligamentous or transligamentous variants of the recurrent motor branch, if you're on the ulnar side of the carpal of the transverse carpal ligament when you release it, that radial leaflet's going to come up and you're going to see those. She had a very nice example of that the other day when I did a an extended type carpal tunnel release to isolate the recurrent motor branch for a nerve transfer. And it's beautiful when you dissect it up and look for it. But most of the times, we're not looking for that branch. In terms of the distal release, you know, that landmark paper that that Dr. Stern had demonstrating that, you know, once you see that, I call it the sentinel fat, but that bright yellow fat that is guarding you from the superficial palmar arch, tell them you got a couple more millimeters of ligament to go, and you're about 13 millimeters away from the arch itself. I think that in order to safely get that, you do need to get those more distal aspects of the superficial palmar fascia that we don't always get when we're doing that dissection down with the sends and the ragnel. And if you really want to see that, you got to release that a little bit. But I don't go much further than that.
Totally agree. And then proximally, I assume you release some of the forearm fascia?
Yeah, I don't slide the tenotomies up, although I know other surgeons do that and can do it safely. I don't think you need to. And again, why take some add some element of risk? Because that is the point where the nerve is closest to the skin. So I try to take the wrist out of any extension that it's in just to keep the nerve as far away from me as possible. And then position the retractors in a way that you and Dr. Calfee and others have showed us in order to get that great view. It almost looks like an endoscopic type view. Absolutely. At that point. And then release the proximal aspect of the transverse carpal ligament if it hasn't already been released in that distal volar antebrachial fascia. I'll take my closed tenotomies, turn it tips up. I usually operate with those tips down, but turn it tips up and feel underneath. And you can see your skin window allows you to get, you know, to the distal forearm and just make sure there isn't anything there. There's always that little bit of fascia that's coming off the palmaris that makes you think they're, you know, you're not completely released, but that usually isn't bothersome.
I think that's well stated, and is exactly how I see it. It's funny when you watch residents operate and gain confidence. Sometimes when they gain confidence, they take chances by cutting when they can't clearly see. And that's my message over and over with the carpal tunnel. It is a straightforward surgery, and you should not screw it up, but you cannot take chances. You have to see what you're cutting. I do tend to slide proximally. I do so with the scissors in the palm as far palmar as possible, which aims my tips up. But I do it when I can see what mm-hmm. I'm sliding. I don't blindly slide.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Great. So we've talked about our mini open incisions. I think both of us do a mini open. We've talked about the role of endoscopic in our practice, or lack of a role.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about postoperative recovery. What have we not discussed?
You know, I think that you know, it's probably better for another episode, but talking about the patient that just doesn't get the relief that you want and how you take them through that. And, you know, certainly a carpal tunnel, technically, we expect it to go perfectly every time, but it's not always the technical aspects of the care that that don't go the way you expect.
I think that's exactly right. And I think we will see anatomy varies. The heavy laborer hand versus the little old lady hand is almost a different operation. But that's right. The lack of a satisfactory result from carpal tunnel release, the reevaluation of such patients, the revision carpal tunnel release, those are great topics.
Yeah, and you know, so I guess a couple technical points I'm trying to think about now. You mentioned the difference in hands and the types of skin. I have to put more local during the Wallant for that leathery worker's hand. And then the thing that, you know, these are always supposed to be some of our least stressful cases. But it's when it's not going the way you want it to go and you can't see the landmarks you want to see, that's when it becomes so stressful. And I don't know what your pearls are for that, but I tend to make the incision a little bigger at that point. I want to see everything. And then I always want to make sure that the palm is flat. Because I've noticed the cases where we're having a hard time, the person sitting on the thumb side just kind of lets the palm creep in a little bit of pronation, and then it slides you right into Guillain's canal.
So those are two fantastic points. And when I'm working with a resident or fellow, we have sen rakes, and we start with the rake end of the sen. Sometimes we flip it to the other end. The beautiful part about the rake end of the sen is you can put the palm wherever you want. It's a great way to flatten the palm.
Yeah, the shaft of that sen will really hold it flat.
Absolutely. And you're right. When I struggle, the incision gets bigger. Yeah. No second thoughts, no regrets. And I have never thought twice about that or regretted making a bigger incision.
Yeah. Well, all right. I think we got our technical stuff out of the way.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Congenital Hand. What about you?
Mine is at ChrisDMD, spelled D-Y. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand. Come back next time.